Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and I hope you and your family are going to have a wonderful Christmas. Now, I had some people thinking there was an ulterior motive to my sensational news Twitter comment this week, but it really was just two things. One, I'd come home from work, put on Twitter and seen that every Celtic fan seemed to be completely obsessed with what position Dave Clark 5 were going to be on in the charts, and I knew that there was a fantastic bit of news coming from how much the Celtic Foundation had raised in the Christmas Appeal. They raised £220,000. Now, to put that in context, just 2 years ago, the Christmas Appeal raised £70,000. It's marvellous. It's marvellous because the work the Foundation team have been doing, to be very fair to the Celtic Football Club itself, there has been Foundation stuff front and centre more and more regularly, mentioned at the AGM with Tony getting to do his presentation. Regularly, if you walk up the Celtic Way, the two banners, prominent banners, either side of the main entrance will be mentioned in the Foundation. And if you want to know the difference that the Foundation makes, real difference it makes in people's lives, contact the team, because you'll be truly astounded by some of the transformational work that goes on to take people from the edge of despair to some positive outlook in their life, former criminals, former drug addicts. And then the work that they do, the work we do with autistic kids, is some of the best work that's going on with autistic children, severely autistic children, in the world. It is really something we can all be proud of. But a quick summary: local families with children, £78,000. Local OAPs, £5,000. Children's charities, £45,000. Women's AIDS charities, £17,000. Homeless, refugees, other vulnerable groups, £75,000. The work that the Foundation has done will ensure that a number of families, over 200 families, 50 local pensioners, will have a much better Christmas than they would have done if it wasn't for the Celtic Foundation and the fantastic contributions made by the Celtic supporters. And I suppose the biggest reason why I was tweeting about it was the frustration I felt that one club, which a lot of football clubs have done fantastic stuff over the last wee while, and instead of football always being the bad guy and football fans being criticised and offensive behaviour at football, like maybe we should spend a bit more time praising football fans for what they did. Rangers got fantastic coverage when their sleepout raised £50,000 for homelessness. The Celtic sleepout was covered in the Blackpool Gazette and Boxing News only, and raised over £70,000. And there's been other events. I don't know, there's been a sleepout at Hampden, and many other clubs have done food bank collections, etc. I think it's about time we started talking about what football fans do and achieve every day of the week. Anyway, enough of my ranting. It's on to the podcast. If you are of a certain age, I'm mid-40s, heaven forfend, my early days as a Celtic memory, you might have similar to mine, are that we were a bit topsy-turvy with goalkeepers. Earliest memories were Dennis Cannon and Ali Hunter fighting it out for the first team spot before Peter Latchford cemented it, and then pre-season tour injury to Peter Latchford let the door in for Pat Bonner, guest of our podcast, and Paddy Bonner was goalkeeper at Celtic for considerable years. And of course, in recent times, we've had the fantastic Boric, Foster and now Craig Gordon. So from that early time when I was a Celtic supporter and the keepers were fighting it out, we have our guest today who's chatting with St Anthony. It's Mr Dennis Cunningham. If you remember the early to mid Celtic time, then you will remember Dennis, who then went on to play for Morton Clyde and played in a Junior Cup final at the end of his career. If you're not, it's just interesting. I always find to listen to tales of Celtic players from a different time. Anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, passing over to him, St Anthony, with him, Dennis Cummins.
It's my pleasure tonight to be joined by the ex-Celtic goalkeeper, Dennis Conan. Now, it's a long time since I've done a podcast with doing the book, so it's good to help Harry Brady out because he's been ploughing a lone furrow with the podcasts. So I'm delighted to be joined by Dennis, and we'll have a wee trip down memory lane and discuss his time at Celtic. But the first question we always ask Dennis is, what was your first Celtic game and who was your first Celtic hero?
Well, my first Celtic game was actually, I made my debut at Dunfermline, which was the midweek game after the debacle at Hampden, the Partick Thistle game, when Celtic lost 4-1 in that, and I was signed on the Monday after that, and there was a game on the Wednesday, and I was playing.
But what about when you were a boy? What would have been your first game when you were a boy?
When I was a boy, that's when I was there when I was an 18-year-old. Honestly, I couldn't remember my first game. It was reserves I played in a few times in that. The one thing I do remember about being here is I played at Parkhead in a reserve game the night that Celtic were at MTK Budapest, the second leg.
Is that when they lost 4-0?
When they lost 4-0 and that. And in those days it was, you know, good crowds going to reserve games and that because they couldn't travel abroad like they do nowadays and that. And obviously the punters had all their radios and that, and they were listening to the game and they were shouting, oh no, that's us getting beat, this and getting beat, that. We could not believe it. That's the one thing I remember about it and that, you know. But when my first game, honestly, Stevie, I couldn't honestly say.
What about when you were a kid then? Who would have been your first hero when you were a wee boy?
Well, but I used to go to the games and that, you know, Johnny Bonner was a goalkeeper at that time, and Johnny, for his lack of height and that, you know, was a great goalkeeper. And I love going to watch him playing and that, you know, and later years I got to know Johnny and that when he, you know, went into the licence trade and I worked in the licence trade. But Johnny Bonner was the first one that I remember and that, you know, as being a, you know, a goalkeeper of any standing and that, you know.
So you alluded to the fact there that you were Celtic early on. So what was the score there? How did you get involved and why did you move on?
I played the schools football with a really good team, which was Holyrood School and in Cross Hill. And our gym teacher at the school was a teacher by the name of John Murphy, who was also the announcer at Celtic Park. And it was through John, and in those days, schools football was very high profile, and that, not that I don't think it is nowadays, and that, you know, I think it's fallen by the wayside, unfortunately. And we can see repercussions in the current, you know, standard of senior players in Scotland and that. In my day, you know, with Harry Hood, Jim McCallog, and prior to me, the school that I went to, Paddy Cairn was there, Charlie Gallagher was there, John Gallagher that went to Third Lanark. And schools football was very high profiling, and it's through playing with the school team and getting a couple of local representative honours that John got me up to Parkhead on trial. And that's when I was about 17 and a half, and I signed as an S form, and I was there for about a year before they let me go. But that was because at that time it was a bit like Jock Steen's days, and Jock always had three goalkeepers at Parkhead when I was there for my second time in the long period. But in those days, you know, when I joined Celtic, Dick Beattie was there, John Fallon was there, and then signed about two or three other S forums and junior boys and that, you know. So obviously at the end of the season they had to let some go and that, you know. So I was released, but as you rightly said earlier, through time, you know, I went back playing junior football. I played with Yoker and then I moved to Renfrew Juniors, and from Renfrew Juniors I went senior again to St Mirren. And I was there for about a year and a bit, and then I went to America for a year. In 1967, the year Celtic won the European Cup, I was actually in America.
Did you go to America to play, or did you go to play?
The manager that signed me at St Mirren was a chap by the name of Doug Millward, who played with Ipswich under Sir Alf Ramsey. And Doug became the manager at St Mirren, and he signed me from Renfrew. And he was only there a matter of a few months when he decided he was leaving. That was the start of football in America, and he was asked to go over there and manage a team in Baltimore. And he was down at Love Street one night, and he jokingly, I met him going into Love Street and that, and blathering away him, and I was asking him how he was getting on. And he said, "Oh, great, you know, he signed a lot of players." I think he did about 12 or 13 different nationalities, mm-hmm. Brazil, Australian, South American, Jamaica. And he says, "Oh, I've got a right good team in that, you know." I says, "Well, you can't have a good team if you don't have a good goalkeeper." And I was only joking.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me and says, "Would you go to America?" And I says, "Probably wouldn't, I, you know." So him and Ali Bright had discussions and that, and I was signed to go to America in about October, November, but it couldn't be released. They kept it under wraps,
mm-hmm.
because St Mirren was, you know, fighting relegation, mm-hmm. and I stayed till March to St Mirren finally get relegated, and then I went over to America for a year and played there.
That must have been some experience.
It was a great experience. I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I enjoyed being in Baltimore. I was fortunate to play with two or three great players and against Dick. Bill Brown had a knee goalkeeper in over, and he played in Toronto. Mm-hmm. Dennis Violet, who was a hero and Man United's top goal scorer in Europe, was in the same team as I was in, and a couple of boys for Real Madrid were there as mm-hmm. well.
Mm-hmm.
So it was good. The level of football was very good and all, but they have rules in America. You can get transferred and you've no say in the matter.
Mm-hmm.
So I was at Baltimore and I was coming home at Christmas. And Doug Milward gave up the job, and a chap by the name of Gordon Jago took it over.
He was QPR, wasn't
he? Yeah. Well, he took over the manager's job,
mm.
and he was wanting to bring in a couple of his own players, and he was wanting me to go to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd spent a year, 9 months or something, getting used to life in America, getting to know people and settling down. And I wasn't too keen in it, to be honest.
So where is Baltimore and
it's just
is it west or east?
It's east coast. It's about an hour's drive from Washington.
Mm.
It's about 200 miles south of New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I came back home at Christmas, and I'd done a bit of training, kept myself fit at Love Street, and mm-hmm. Alec Wright had invited me, told me to come down and keep myself fit before I was going back to America. But the more I was here, and Gordon Jago was pushing the point, no, I'd like to go to Boston and that, you know, but I thought, no, I'm not going to Boston, because I spent a year getting used to people and used to places, and then go and start it all over again. And Alec Wright asked me if I'd come back. He said, "Man," and I said, "Yeah, I'll come back, Alec." And he'd approached Baltimore, and I came back to St Mirren.
Do you regret not going to Boston later years?
Not really, no. No, because at that time I was going with my current one, who turned out to be my wife, and for me to go back there, it was causing problems. Mm. You know, I couldn't invite Bridie out to America, and me travelling all over the US, and she's stuck in one city not knowing people and everything else. So there was that drawback on it and all. And when I came back here, I came home for Christmas in 67, and I was due to go back in March to America. I came back here, I was doing training, I met up with Bridie again and that, you know, and I went back and I thought, no, I'll stay here, and quite half here, and down through the years, I've no regrets at all in that, you know.
And so we Celtic won the European Cup then. Where was Dennis Conaghan that day?
I was in Baltimore, and I was got a phone call from my parents, who were here, and that, they phoned me to let me know Celtic had won the European Cup, you know. And I was absolutely over the moon, obviously, about it, and I actually went to training the next day. And as I said to you earlier, Stephen, a couple of boys were Real Madrid.
Yeah, yeah.
Santi Esteban played with Real Madrid. And if you remember, after the European Cup final, Stefano invited...
The testimonial.
Yeah. And Santi Esteban heard about this and that, and he came in to train, and knew I was from Scotland, and he was saying, "Denny said, Celtic European Cup, and...
Mm.
number 7 Jimmy Johnson, fantastic," and that, you know, he was talking to people from Spain and that, and obviously, as we've seen in the television, Jimmy was a, you know, out of this world that night, and the Stefano, so good news travels fast, you know. So but and that's when I was in America, and then of course then my parents sent all my papers, the newspapers over of the European Cup final and the testimonial, and that's when I got to read at them, and then I let a couple of the English boys and everything else to rub it into them, and the Spanish boys to let them see it as well, and I, you know, so there was a good rapport in that, you know. Mm-hmm. I did enjoy it, and you made good friends in that, you know. Mm-hmm. But I've no regrets about coming back, absolutely none.
So you went back to Ulster and you made a good reputation for yourself. Now, there's one game that I don't remember, obviously, but I've done a wee bit of research through the years, and I came across a newspaper, and St Mirren beat Rangers at Love Street, and you were the hero of the day. It was quite a rare victory for St Mirren.
It was, I remember the day. It was a cold, frosty day. And
Colin Steen had just signed for Rangers. Colin, he scored Steen, all his goals.
That's right.
And you were the first guy to keep him out.
He'd played, I think, three games before we played him, and I think he scored hat-tricks in three games. Or Colin might have scored three hat-tricks in a row, and he came to Love Street, and it was a cold, frosty day, and that, you know. And we were fortunate enough to win 1-0. I think, God rest him, he's dead now. He scored the goal, wee Hughie Gilshan. And I think something in my mind, wee Hughie's passed away. I could be wrong, and I would love to be wrong, but I think he's a... But it was one of those days where things go well for you, and you know, obviously, it's great memories of, you know, winning that game. And I think we had a new centre half came in, a young boy that day, to play against Colin Steen, a young boy by the name of Andy McFadden. And Andy playing against him was every bit as good as I might have been, because, you know, he stopped Colin Steen from scoring and that, you know. But a result of that, and it certainly brought publicity and everything else in that to his TV and that, you know.
But Big McQueen been there at the time?
Gordon came slightly after that. Gordon came slightly after that as well, and I played with Gordon, and who went on to play for Scotland. And my new Archie Gemmell was in the team as well.
That's right, Archie Gemmell.
Could
you tell when McQueen was younger that he was going to be as good as he became?
You could, yeah. He was just dominant. I mean, when he first came into the team, I think he was only about 18, and he'd ever, you know, he was great in the air. He was very left-footed now, you know, but he was a confident big boy, and he was well brought up in football, because I think his uncle or his father worked for Beath Juniors. I'm sure it was down about that way.
He's an Ayrshire boy,
and that, you know, so he had a good upbringing in football and that, and a good ground, and you know, he settled in right away. But the people round about him were great, and all. Wally Fulton was tremendous as a leader, you know. He was sweeper for St Mirren, and a boy by the name of Jim Kieran, they were playing beside him and that, so he was getting good advice and good training and good encouragement and that. And you could see that he was going to make the grade without any doubt about it and that, you know.
And what about Ian Munro, would he have been around about
that? Ian was there at that time.
He was a good player as
Ian
well.
Ian was a great player, and all left back. He started out as an outside left, but then he moved to left back, and we all know what he done. He went on to play for Rangers. We had a lot of good players in that St Mirren team. Gordon,
Jim Blair
was in the team. Bobby McKean, who went to Rangers as well. Jim Blair went down south, and he came back up to play for Hibson and that, you know. Tony Coyle, two fullbacks were superb. Cammy Murray could have went anywhere in England, but throughout a loyalty, stayed with St Mirren. Tottenham Hotspur were after him, but he stayed with St Mirren. Tony Coyle, who played with Thurlanner before they went down the Swanee, he ended up coming. Well, I knew Tony because he was at Holyrood at the same time as I was there, and Tony was a great left back and that, you know. But so in that, throughout that team, there was really good top class players in that, you know, you were fortunate enough to play with in that, yeah.
So 1971 came, and St Mirren got to the semi final of the League Cup, and you had a good game at Hampden, even though Celtic won 3-0.
Nothing.
But you might not have known what was in the corner, because you alluded to it at the beginning there, that in the final Thistle gave Celtic a doing before one, and Evan Williams sort of, like, rightly or wrongly, took the rap in a lot of ways for the goals. So within a matter of days, Big Jock's in the transfer market, and he's after a goalkeeper at Newcombe. So when did you first have an inkling that something was happening?
This might seem strange, but I had an inkling a few times, because any time there was any problem at Celtic Park, and as you rightly alluded to there, a lot of the time the goalkeeper took the brunt of it at Parkhead, and that, you know, okay, we were all infallible, we made mistakes and everything else, but 9 times out of 10 the goalie would take the blame. I think the only goalkeeper that never get blamed for any was Ronnie, you know, because Ronnie would be pointing his finger blaming somebody else, you know, if you let in a goal, and let everybody, Ronnie's lost bad goals in his day, you know. But as I said earlier, Stevie, the announcer at Parkhead was John Murphy, and a couple of times he'd mentioned to me, And also a school friend of mine was actually Jock Steen's son-in-law, John Gatland, mm-hmm. who married Ray Steen. Mm-hmm. And John and I and Harry Hood were friends even after we left school. And a couple of times when we'd meet up to go out for a meal or something, John would mention, I think a big man's coming to talk to you, I think a big man's coming to talk to you. Mm-hmm. But it never materialised. And the night of the cup final, the Partick Thistle game, John met up with John again and that, and he says, big man's going to phone you the weekend, Dennis. And I says, John, I've heard this 17 times for you now, you know. But sure enough, I got a phone call, and it was Jock Steen himself and that, you know, about coming to Parkhead. He says, I'd like to meet up with you. He says, I'll meet you at Rooton Glen. I was working in Barhead at the time. He says, I'll meet you at the car park in Rooton Glen. I'll have a discussion with you and that, you know. I says, fine, Mr. Steen, and I look forward to it and that, you know. But about an hour later, the phone went. He says, Dennis, I changed your plans. Meet at Love Street. Spoke to Wilson Humphreys. We're in agreement. He says, if you want, we'll meet at Love Street and see how the deal can go and that, you know. So that's what happened on the, I think it was the Tuesday. I went down to Love Street, met Wilson Humphreys and that, and discussed the situation about they were quite happy with the transfer fee and they were willing to let me go and that, you know. So it was just a case of myself talking to Big Jock and that, you know. And I don't think it was going to be any problem me, you know, looking for the skies or anything else and that, you know, to look for anything untoward, because there were set rules at the park and that, you know, that was the starting wage and that bonuses and everything else. It was the European Cup players and that were probably on a bit more and rightly so and that, you know, but if you were signing for Celtic at that time, that was the first team wage and that, you know, so I wasn't going to jeopardise anything or look for the moon and that, so I was quite happy to sign for Celtic at that time and that, you know. And there wasn't any problem in that situation, that, you know. So it's something I was looking forward to, that, you know.
It's funny you're talking about the boy Garland. There's a football book I've got, and it shows you a photo of his wedding, and you're in the wedding photograph. And Colin Jackson's there.
Colin, that's right.
And he's wearing a white. He unusually, everybody's dressed in black. Mm-hmm. For some reason, he's got a white dinner jacket on. It looks like James Bond.
Colin's was a big smoothie.
What's the link with Colin Jackson? Why would he have been there?
It just came out of friendship and that, you know. I don't know. I used to go to a pub after a game on a Saturday night, a friend of mine, after I came back from America. Mm-hmm. My father wasn't well and there was a nurse was looking after him. She would come in and look after him. And her husband was a publican who used to go to Holyrood, but he was a few years ahead of us. So I went down to this pub a couple of times and the person was actually Ollie Fernie's brother-in-law, Norrie Douglas. So I got friendly with Norrie and I, you know. And then John Gatlin, Harry, we were friends as well. So we'd go there for a beer and that, you know, or if we were going out for a meal. And then Big Colin came in the scene for some reason. I don't know how Colin eventually came on the scene, because I think he got friendly through, you know, just after the game friendships now, because there wasn't there's a rivalry on the park, but a lot of players were friends off the park as well now, you know. Daniel McLean, I became very friendly with George McLean and that, you know, when we used to meet up the town after a game, he was with Rangers and that, and after he left St Mirren. He was at Rangers and Dixie Deans would be there. A lot of the boys used to go into Reeds and Hope Street and meet up there and then just go a different way. Some would go to dance and some would go home and that, meet up with their girlfriends or whatever. And there was that kind of clique of players, and I think it may have been through that, and Colin was just part of that, you know, and he became very friendly and that, you know.
I just wonder, because that white jacket on, he stands out a mile. Apart from being the only ex-Rangers player, he stands out a mile with a jacket. So within a matter of weeks of joining up at Celtic, you played your first Celtic Rangers game in the New Year game. And it's quite a dramatic one. It's one each. It's going into injury time. And the last guy in the park you would expect to score a winning goal was Jim Brogan. And Jim scores with a header. And the reason why I bring that up is that there's a nice photograph. You see Brogan scoring, and down the other end of the park, you can clearly make out your silhouette, and you're doing a massive leap in the air, just as the ball hits the net.
I remember Jim never scored a lot of goals, but I remember that day, and that, you know, and as you rightly said, it was nearly just the last minute or two of the game, and that. And what I remember about that game was Davy Hayton was playing, and Davy and I ran towards each other. And then all of a sudden, Davy stopped and says, oh no, we better get back into position again and that, you know. The tears ran and then stopped and came back. But I remember it, you know, it was that was my first game in an Old Firm game, and everything was totally different, you know, the atmosphere and also the tension and everything else. And to score a goal in the last minute or two, you know, it was absolutely tremendous. And for somebody like Jim Brogan, who wasn't the most prolific of goal scorers and that, you know, it was a big thing for him as well and that, you know.
I mean, Jim must have played something like, I don't know, off the top of my head, 300 games for Celtic. And that's the one he's always remembered for, is obviously getting that goal.
The goal, yeah.
His claim to fame.
Well, he didn't let you forget it either,
No, I bet he was proud.
Well, there again, I knew Jim Brogan after, you know, from the football, out with the football, because Jim's family lived in, his parents lived in Pollock Shields, just round the corner from where we were, and they were in the flower business, they were in the florist business and that, you know. So I got to know his mum and dad and that, because we stayed there and they were only round the corner and that, so I got to know Jim and I got to know Frank and that, you know. Well, Frank was at Parkhead at the time I was there as a schoolboy and that, you know, so prior knowledge to the family and that, you know, but Jim was... He was 100% no, you know. He was, Jim was a diehard.
You say he was a character.
He was that. He was quite a lot. Oh, he was quite, you know, strong-willed and strong-minded and that, you know. He certainly liked to put his point across and win his point and that, you know. As far as I know, he's not in good health just now. And that,
I've heard that for a wee while, you know, but it's sad to hear because, you know, it's...
It's more and more happening, Stevie, now, you know. I need to phone me Bobby Lennox and actually find out, because I've heard that many stories about other ones, and, you know, and I don't want to mention too many names.
I know.
There's personal between
us.
I see Big Billy in the television. He doesn't look well in that, you know. Tommy Gemmell is his ups, and he's not too well. I've heard the other day that Harry Hood's supposed to be not well. I know Harry had a touch of cancer and that, you know, but... From what I read in the paper, I thought he was over the worst of it, and that, you know. But I was talking to somebody there just at the weekend, and that, and he says, I heard Harry's got cancer. I said, I heard the big C, but treatment for it away 6-9 months ago.
Yeah.
So I was under the impression he was all right. So I need to phone me Bobby Lennox and just see.
See how he is, or how
they, you know, they all are, because we're at that time in of our life, and there's more and more prevalent things between Alzheimer's, dementia, and. What players, the knocks they took in those days, and the kind of treatment you got, and that, you know, it was the cold sponge and everything.
It was quite primitive in the days, wasn't it?
It was, and that, you know, that's it. You know, nowadays, I mean, they're very, very professional, and now it's all about you eating what you don't eat, and, you know, your training habits and everything else, and that, you know. But in those days, I remember one time, I wasn't even at Celtic Park, but Celtic were playing Kilmarnock, and Big Billy done his ankle in. And according to the press and that, there was no chance of him playing, but they were down at Seamill. He was told to go into salt water and that, and walk about the salt water, that would be great for it. Big Billy gets strapped up and played again on the Wednesday night.
Well, some of the Lisbon lines refer to the Seamill water as Lourdes.
Well, that was where you go in there
you
for a battle.
You sent there and you came out and you were expected to be
miraculously. I always remember miraculously the season. And that's it, you went in for a paddle there, and I go for a walk in the salt water and I got rid of your aches and pains and that, you know. But that was it.
So you lost your place in 72, Evan got back in the team. And not long after that, Ali Hunter came, and then after that, Peter Latchford came. So the point I'm going to make is, there's only, for a goalkeeper, there's only one position you can play in the pitch. It's not as if you can double up and play at full-back or sweeper or midfield or something like that. So what I'm going to ask is, what was the relationship like between the goalkeepers? Because it must have been very competitive, because you don't want to play on a Saturday.
It was 100% competitive, because we're all professional, like, you know. But I'll tell you what, they're their own band of men and that, you know, because they know it's a privileged position that you're playing in, but it's a specialised position, as you rightly say, Stevie. You know, you can only play to be a goalkeeper and that, you know, unless you're injured. And it was prior to the days of, you know, substitutes, and you went outside right or something like that, you know, and somebody else went and goal. There was rivalry, yeah, because everybody wanted to be in the team, but you had to do a couple of things really bad before you went out of the team and that, you know. But I remember Big Jock saying, you know, at training and that, you know, that when he passed away, he wanted to come back as a Celtic goalkeeper, because Celtic didn't know the attacking and that, you know, and the goalkeeper didn't need to do anything and that, you know. But goalkeepers was his pet hate, you know. He said it was the easiest job under the sun, you know, but he worked as hard at the park and that, you know. But there was never any animosity or like that. No. We became friends, okay, we had our own friends within the group, the team, but there was never any animosity or rivalry or falling out. And that, you know, and I got on well with Evan when he was there. When Ali Hunter came, Ali was as good a friend as well. And I remember when Ali first came, in the days of Scotsport, Ali was playing, and it was a big joke was on Scotsport after, you know, at the 10 o'clock on a Saturday night, and I don't know if it was Arthur or Bob Cramsey who sees him, and what do you think, Ali Hunter? Ali had a great game sort of thing, and that, you know, and joke says, I could be the Scotland goalkeeper for the next 10 years, you know, and that's what jokes estimate of people and that, you know. And Ali was going through a good time period at that time when things was going well. I was there for 5.5 years, but I never went out through bad play, and I've done a couple of howlers in my time and that, you know. It was always through injury I went out, and that was the annoying thing and that, you know. And credit to the other goalkeepers, no matter who it was, when they get in, they took that chance. And they were in for their today. Something happened, or invariably they get injured, or two or three howlers in a row, and that. The goalkeeper invariably stayed in, and that, you know, played for it.
Was there any specialist goalkeeping coach at the time, the way they get now, or were you just left to do your own thing?
No, you done your own warm up, and then Big Joe done the goalkeeping. He took the goalkeepers, and that, he'd done the warm up and the shooting in and things like that. And he'd got you the exercises, and the rest of the boys would be training and doing their thing. But Big Joe would be working the three goalkeepers. There was always three there. You know, Tom Lally, who never, you know, was a goalkeeper.
Well, Gordon Marshall was there for a
while. Gordon Marshall was there, and Gordon Lett. John Fallon was still there when I went. Gordon Marshall, and Gordon, I think, went to Aberdeen. I'm not 100% sure. I think he went up north. John Fallon went to Malone. But
he talked about a couple of foreign guys. Remember a couple of trialists. A guy called Geir Carlson that came from Dunfermline, and a guy called Leif Nielsen who came from Morton.
Big Geir actually played against us. Was it Rosenberg?
Rosenberg.
My memory's not as bad. Played against Celtic in the European Cup. In the European Cup.
That's right.
And home and away, and next thing the big man was there, you know, and all of a sudden it was another goalkeeper. And that's not counting, you know, a couple of the young boys that were there, you know, the S-forms and things like that were there as well. Because I remember Big Joe played one of them, in fact, the Scottish Cup tie, a boy by the name of Graham Bartley.
Graham Bartley,
and a Sunday game and that, you know, you turn up and that young Graham's in goal. So they always had at least three goalkeepers there and that, you know, during my period. And I don't think it was any different any time the time he was there, but his pet hate was a goalkeeper. Because they thought it was the easiest job under the sun, you know.
So who was the big characters in the dressing room in the days then? Who was the sort of the
main? Obviously Dixie. Yeah, Dixie was a character. You know, grateful in that, you know, off the park, you know, in the park, they liked a good time, they liked a thing. So, and the other character mostly was wee Jimmy, and that, you know, wee Jimmy would sing Rod Stewart the second, and that, you know, he just loved to impersonate and sing Rod Stewart, and that, you know, they were the two main ones. For, you know, clowning about. Pat McCluskey was another one. They enjoyed, you know, a good time and that, you know, and Pat was a nice guy as well and that, you know, they were the three ones that would be the wind-ups and the cattle. Sometimes Wee Lou could be a wee bit, Lou McCary could be a bit of a character as well and that, you know, but they were all a great one. We're all a great bunch of lads.
It's been described as quite a dressing room. You had to fight your own corner, if you like, because, you know, if you were wearing, I don't know, maybe loud shoes or something like that, or you had a bad game in training, you know, that would be picked on.
They were slow in getting on to you, and I, you know, when
the good natured stuff.
There was no animosity, and I, you know, they'd wind you up, and as soon as you know you came in, with, as you said, you know, a floral shirt on or something like that, you know, this thing. Where are you going to with that thing on? And I, you know, they were a good bunch of boys.
Because I've read it said that part of the reason George Connolly struggled a wee bit was his nature didn't allow for that. He was much more quieter and introverted. And around about all these guys that are noising people up and having a good time and being what we might call the Glaswegian noise-ups, George maybe coming from a wee village in Fife.
Him and Davy Hay were really, really, you know, they were two great buddies at the park and that, you know, and Davy kind of looked after him or tried bring him out of his shell. But George, as you rightly say, is through from Fife, and he would go straight back there, you know, after training. And he's the only one from there. Whereas invariably, you know, the ones in the West, and that, you know, they would all go under Jimmy and Dixie, or Jimmy and Bobby Murdoch, and all they would go out Hamilton direction. I would go into the city centre with Harry Hood and Dixie, or and be Lou McCarry, and maybe go for a coffee somewhere in the town, and that, you know, a lunchtime before we went home. And whereas George was always heading away off to Fife on his own. But he was just very quiet and that, you know. Great player and such a...
I was about to bring that up, but you played, probably saw him at close quarters, because he was the sweeper and you were the goalie. I mean, how good a player was he at his best?
He was absolutely magnificent, George. And nothing ruffled him in that, you know. He was very much like Beckenbauer and that, you know. He kind of glided over the ground and that, you know, and he could read things and that. Okay, Big Billy beside him and that, to help along. Bobby Murdoch was there and that, the good advice. But he just covered the ground and a great passer of the ball and that, you know. And, you know, he could beat a man in a sixpence and that. George did everything. It was just such a shame the way he went out of the game and that, you know. And it was a loss to the game, really, and that, you know. He could have, the standards he could have reached was unbelievable. And I was lucky enough to end up playing with him once away after that. And it was junior football.
Oh, is that Sauchie?
Sauchie. George went to Sauchie, and that's when he finished up and that, you know, playing football through there. And I ended up getting picked for Junior Scotland. And the manager of the team was Big John Hughes, Yogi. And he picked me and he picked George Connolly. And that squad, and I met up with George, you know, a few years
How was he in later years then? Did
he was good at that time. As far as I know, he's still doing all right. Because I'm still working, you know. And for a period of time with the company I'm with, I was through in Fife doing deliveries and that, you know, round the area for George stays, and I'd asked a couple of people about him, the chemist shops that I was delivering it, and saying, I believe George Connolly comes from Valleyfield, the next village to where. So I big man, oh, he's driving a taxi and that, you know. And I thought to myself, that's good then, that's the only knowledge I had of him, but at least he was still.
Well, his son goes on Twitter, and
does he?
Yeah, and apparently he's in a good place. You know, he's happy and he's contented, and, you know, he seems to be. Moved on a wee bit in later life, which is good to know that.
Well, that's why I was glad from that. I'm talking about maybe 4 or 5 years ago when I'd done a lot of the Fife runs, but I'm down in Ayrshire now. You know, I made the inquiry when I was delivering that, because I was in High Valleyfield and I've been next to it, and I'd saying, by the way, George Connolly live about here. Oh, I drives a taxi and I loaded. Oh, and say, that's good. And you know, if he's ever in, tell that boy Dennis Connolly, and was asking for him and that, and just left it at that, you know. Because as we said earlier, you know, talking about at the age that we're getting to now, you often wonder and worry how people are getting and that. And George, we hear things, I mean, I got a Christmas card there for Harry Hood, and I got one for Big Billy there a couple of days ago and that, you know. And Big Billy said, Liz sent me his new address and that, you know, because I didn't know he had moved. I knew he stayed over when he stayed in the Mearns, I'd been in his house and that, you know, but I didn't know he'd moved now. So there's still that relationship, and occasionally I'll phone me Bobby Lennox and that, just to keep in touch and see how things are and that, you know.
So when you played that international thing for the Scotland Juniors with George, did George reminisce about the old days? Was he happy to talk about it?
Aye, George, it was great. He said, it's great to meet up with you and that, and we were staying down, stayed down at Largs and that, because the game was down there and that. We stayed down at Lars, we had a good blather and I talk about the old days and that, you know, and how things had moved on and that, you know, and he didn't want to bring up,
personal.
He had he done what he done and he decided what he was going to do and nobody was going to change his mind and that, you know. But it was just, from that point of view, it was good seeing him, that he was still back involved in football and he was recognised that the player he was and that, and he strolled through that game, you know, the Junior Scotland game and that, you know, and as I said there, to find out a few years later again that he's still, you know, things are going well with him and that, you know, and that's all you want to hear, the people and that, you know, that because sometimes it can go really bad and that, you know, but I was pleased that everything went well for him.
So 1974 was your best year at Celtic. Now, the first thing that came across in 74, isn't it a particularly pleasant memory? It was Atletico Madrid. Now, this must have been an exciting time. It's a European Cup semi-final. And I remember as a boy going to the game and my dad being quite excited for the point of view that I reckon Celtic were maybe just the favourites to win over the two legs. And yet nothing could have prepared us for what happened that night at Celtic Park.
It was a fiasco from start to finish, in all honesty. I mean, it wasn't a football match. It was just a, you know, kick lumps out of every one of his Celtic players. And one of the most goal, it finished nothing each. One of the most goal, I think, but a goal disallowed early on.
Yeah.
You know, Harry gets to the byline, cuts it back, and Kenny sticks it away. And all of a sudden, the linesman gives a bad kick or something like that, you know. But the annoying thing was their manager, he, I think he was Uruguayan, I think.
Argentinian, Carlos Lorenzo.
Yeah. And what he done, he only played half his team, and he brought in six hatchet men. In all honesty, and I've got a DVD of the game, and it shows you some of the tackles. Now, I was talking to a few friends at the weekend about the game and that, you know, we were just reminiscing about. And I'm saying, I say to him, I says, I'll give you the DVD. I says, it looks even worse now than actually during the 90 minutes, because it happens and all of a sudden there's a carry-on, there's a book and everything else that blows over. But when I sat here and I watched the DVD of the game, I could not believe some of the tackles. Especially with Jimmy, he got kicked out of lumps. Kenny got hammered a few times and that, you know. But they four or five players that definitely went out. And because the manager knew they weren't going to be playing the next game. He was playing to get one result and get us back there in his own place with a, you know, not two goals down or a goal down or anything else. He had something to play for. And, you know, from the, I mean, I remember the boy Ayala played up front. He got booked because he stopped me from throwing the ball out. I was throwing the ball out and he put his hand up and just blocks me throwing the ball out. And the Turkish referee booked him and that, you know, and they put three players sent off. But it was an absolute fiasco from start to finish. And that wasn't a game of football, it was just a kick match. And that, you know.
I remember, as I said, I was only a kid at the time, and I don't remember Racing Club, but I remember my dad commenting at the time that their left back had played by Racing Club. And the alarm bells began to ring at that point. You're like, if they're as bad, surely they can't be as bad as the Argentinians were. In 67, if anything, they were worse.
They were worse, oh yeah. I've only seen snippets of that, you know, on the television. Mm. You know, they carry on with Tommy Gemmell and everything else and the fight and everything in that game. But they were, I mean, it was absolutely horrendous, the game and that, you know.
I did a wee bit of research recently and I was reading the comments after the game and Celtic get criticised with a nothing each draw at Celtic Park because they were down to 8 men at one point and me couldn't get through them. Now, with the best ball in the world, a good team should be able to score against eight men at some point. But the one thing we did get praised for was the fact we kept our composure and we kept our dignity. We didn't lose the rag and end up... We didn't turn it into a brawl. They were the brawlers. But, you know, if there is a negative point, when you're playing eight men, you know, even one goal might have been a difference.
It may well have done, and that is always a point. It's really, how can you not beat eight men? But, you know, when there was no fluid... fluidity about the game. I mean, everything, went 10 yards, it was a free kick, it was stop start. And when they get down to the situation, they just all sat, the rest of them all sat back. They were nobody up the park. So to get by 8 men, and their goalkeeper done well that night. You know, the boy, I mean, he covered everything, all the crosses and everything else. And what he done, they were wasting time, you know. When he'd get the boy kick out for a throw in, he wasn't kicking it to him, they just kicked the ball away at the park.
Waste time
and that, and run down the clock and that, you know. And I suppose when you look at it, you can't beat 8 men, but there was no... I would guarantee you every 10 seconds or every half a minute there was a free kick given, and they were just all men behind the ball and that, and kick it out for a throw-in and that, you know. And probably out of the 90 minutes, you only played for 45.
You know? And if you're lucky.
If you're lucky and that, you know, there was that many stop-starts and brawls and everything.
So what was the feeling after the game then? Was Jock sad about it, or was he so optimistic we could win in Madrid?
He was angry and that, you know, he was really angry, but first of all, the standard of the play and the way they played and that, you know. And what I think annoyed, because we put in a protest to
UEFA,
and I think the club were hoping that they might have got thrown, put out there or something like that, made behind to play behind closed doors or some sort of form, or as happened to Celtic in later years, you know, forced to go and play a game in Manchester and that, you know, rather than, you know, whether we go and play the game in London or they don't play, go to Madrid. And there was hope at the park that some action might have been taken against them of some sort, but as it turned out, I think we were going to a midweek game the following week. We were up at Pau Fowlis, up at the hotel up there, and I knew, I think we were going to play Dunfermline. And Big Jock, we had the meal and we were all outside stand walking about, and that, you know, Big Jock called us all together, and he says, I just want you to know we've got to go to Europe. Mm. We've got to go to Madrid and play this game. That's what UEFA decided, and that, you know. And a lot of the boys were pretty annoyed at that situation, that, you know. So, with the best will in the world, you know, after having gone through when they went through, when this mob's away from home, we're going to go out there and say, what the hell is it going to be like in Madrid, you know?
Well, this was still Spain under a dictator, Jules Franco. And by all accounts, the Spanish newspapers reported back to the Spanish that we had been the ones causing the problem, and the Turkish referee was a homer, and all the rest of the stuff. So, not only did they get away with them, but they done they turned the circle on us. So that when we went to Madrid, as you'll know, then we were seen to be the bad guys, but which was never the case.
No, that's how they turned everything into their favour, and you know, as you rightly said. Plus the fact that there was threats against wee Jimmy and Big Joe. We never left the hotel. Mm-hmm. You know, we went, done our training, came back to the hotel. Now, when any time we were abroad, you had free time to yourself, and the boys let you go through in the city centre, and you know, some of them go into shops and do that. A lot of others would let you go and see, you know, basilicas. Places of interest and that, you know. And that's what we always done in that, you know. But you went to training, came back, and that was you stuck in a hotel and that, you know. Sitting at the swimming pool, well, obviously the way the weather was in Madrid, you couldn't go outside sunbathe and you end up getting burnt and that, you know. So invariably you were inside all the time and just sitting about and doing nothing. And that's not good preparation for a game either, and that, you know. And as I said, plus the fact the threats were made against the wee man and Big Job and that, you know, that their crowds are, you know, outside the hotel making noises and everything else. It wasn't the best preparation.
What kind of atmosphere was it in the stadium? It must have been horrendous.
It was horrendous. The crowd were baying at us all the time. In fact, I had to report to the referee at one stage. It was a boy firing pellets for a sling from behind the goal and that, you know, and they were getting hit with these things and that, you know. So I picked up a couple and I went to the referee and he'd kind of inform somebody about it and that, you know, but there's nothing done about it and that, you know. I remember after the game and I called her on the manager or the chairman and that, he wanted to come and see Big Joe and shake his hands and Big Joe. Told him where to go and that, you know. And we done all right in that game considering.
75 minutes. We were nearly there. If they'd taken the lead, away goals counting double, they'd have needed two, and they might not have got the two because we lost the second goal, and again, you'll know better than me when we were attacking.
So, trying to get something out of the game. It was just the goal. In fact, and that we held on for 70 odd minutes, as you say, Stevie, and that, you know. And you were thinking, we may get some now, might still win and that, you know, but it wasn't it to be, unfortunately. That was a disappointing thing. Everybody was disappointed, but just glad to get away from it. And a bit disappointed, as you see in later years, what happens to clubs now. Relation to, you know, how, as I said, at Celtic later years and that, you know, allegedly somebody did throw a bottle, but the boy goes down as if it's hit him and it's nowhere near him and and Celtic, you know, they qualified for the game and they won the
fair
game.
Fair and square.
Aye, that's it, they'd won it fair and square, but then they were forced to go and play at Manchester again and that and lost 1-0 and that, you know. How UEFA changed in the late years with their rulings in relation to crowd behaviour and everything else and what people do in the park and everything, and players do in the park and that, you know. It wasn't, unfortunately, it was before our time.
But on a happier note, they came home from Madrid and we get 9 in a row at Brockville. It was the best performance, I have to say. I won each draw. But the photographs you see at the time, when the players are doing the lap on it after the game, Madrid's still in their mind because they don't look particularly happy. They've just won a league title, it should be a happy time, but you can see the sort of the pressure on their faces.
Could have been easy. It wasn't easy, you know, and as you rightly said, we didn't play that well, and there was a kind of aftermath of Madrid getting beaten, Madrid, and I think we went 1-0 down, if I'm not mistaken. And Kenny equalised that, you know. And it was just a kind of aftermath of that, you know, and the pressure. It wasn't the best of performances and that, you know. And it was only a time when we went inside and that, you know, Big Joe says, come on, he's won the league, he's done it 9 in a row. Just get the European thing out of your mind and that, you know. It's done and dusted and we can't do anything about it now. He's won the league and that, so just make sure you enjoy it and that, you know. But there was still that feeling, the disappointment of what happened in midweek and that, you know. But in fact, you know, it's amazing. Somebody asked me that one night. I was up at Celtic Park for an interview and the boy was interviewing me. He says, what was the score at Brockville when they won the league? And that's Harry Hood and a couple of, and none of us could remember the score.
Yeah, yeah.
We couldn't remember it, but that, and as you brought up the point, it's just something away in the back of your mind. It's not something that, it's not a game I remember a lot about either.
No, no.
I'm trying to think of the goal I lost. I can't even remember the goal I lost and how bad it was.
Well, there is a you know, the good thing that came out of the Atletico Madrid thing, they got to the final against Bayern Munich, and I remember watching that again in the house with family, and they were about 90 seconds away from winning a damn thing, and we couldn't believe it, you know. So justice was done. Bayern get equalised and gave them a doing in the replay.
The replay, that was the 100%. I remember that, you know, and we were talking about it apart the next day or whatever, and we were saying, you watch your game last night, we've been at more 90 seconds away from winning it, and it was a big midfielder for Germany, and scored for outside the box and that, you know.
That's right.
And then the replay, then they won 4-1 and that.
Do you know, we went to Spain with holidays that summer, and in those days, you didn't really have a replica kit, you basically just had a green and white tap, and that was it. There wasn't any badge that I reckon, or any Nikes or Umbros, or whatever you want to call it. And I was running about in this, and my dad got talking to this German guy who was a Bayern Munich fan. And the Bayern Munich fan says, you know, he says, we were very much hoping for a Bayern Celtic final. He says, that would have been a feast of football, he says, rather than, because even they appreciated, they must have saw the footage of what happened.
What happened at Parkhead, aye.
And he says, you know, it wasn't a great final, he says, but Celtic against Bayern Munich, with Jimmy Johnson and Kenny Dalglish, and you know, the rest of the players against Beckenbauer and Gert Müller, and what
that'd have been a great
one occasion that would have been,
been smashing it. That was the unfortunate, that was a goal.
And on a personal level, you were down at the chance of playing in a final,
because
you would have been a keeper in the final.
That's the unfortunate, I'd like to think. but that was a galling thing, you know. But you know, when you look at Celtic's record in those days, you know, they were getting the quarterfinals and semi-finals on a regular basis. I think out of the 9 years, I think there was about 5 semi-finals and, or 5 quarterfinals and 3 semi-finals, 2 finals and everything else. You know, the standard of what they'd done, you know, in the 9 years that they'd won the league.
It wasn't just a domestic domination. The fact that they were hitting the target in Europe as well, which makes it even more impressive.
That was the thing. So, and you know, in recent years, unfortunately, you know, okay, football's moved on dramatically and that, you know, but during that period when Celtic were winning their 9 in a row, they were still doing well in Europe and keeping the standards up. Some Scottish clubs, Aberdeen done it in later years, Rangers done it as well and that, you know, but a record in general in those days and that, you know, the standard of football and how we competed in Europe and done well in Europe was great,
So the last game of the 74 season was a Scottish Cup final against Dundee United. Now, we're very much the favourites. United were the team that they became under Jim McLean, but they still had good players, most notably Andy Gray, who was making a big name for himself at the time. Now, it was 1-0 for Celtic, and the turning point of the game was maybe one of your best saves when you kept out Gray.
Andy, I remember. Andy, and you know, he even mentioned it in his book, and when he brought out a book, and he made a point of mentioning that in the book as well. And I keep thinking that if Andy, what made that for me was Andy put height on it, and it was away to my right hand side. If Andy put that low down on either side, I think it'd have been a different kettle of fish in that, you know. It was just a perfect height for me to go and just throw my body at it, and I was fortunate enough to get a hand on it. But I keep thinking about it, and when people ask me about it afterwards, and I'm saying, yeah, Andy made that for me with the height and of it, and it had a lot of power in it as well, and that, you know, so it only needed a tuck of glance to divert it. If he'd just put a wee nod down either side, and that, more of an angle, he made it too good a header and too much power on it. I keep saying to myself, I wonder if I'd got it if he'd put it low down on either side of me and that, you know, where you've got to get down across your goal and that, you know. But it's something that I remember and that, you know, and it was great. I was absolutely over the moon.
He was actually on the radio for a few years in the talk sport, if you remember, before he got unceremoniously turfed over.
That's right.
He was talking one day, I think he was talking to Alan Brazil, and they were reminiscing. They were talking about the cup final, and your name got mentioned. He says, a goalkeeper, Connigan, he says, broke my heart. He says, I thought I'd scored. He says, and the next thing, you saved it. And that killed Dundee United, because that was their chance.
If they
equalised at that point, they'd have made a game of it. But as it happens, we were only 1-3-0 and fairly comfortably, which was good for us.
It was great for me, you know, because I know, my first season at Celtic Park, I played, you know, from about November through to about March. and then I picked up an injury and I was out of the team and Evan came in, and that was the year Sally went to the cup final and won 6-1. They beat Hibs 6-1 and that, you know, and you keep saying to yourself, well, good luck to you, Evan, you went in, you took your chance. But I'm saying to myself, Christ, it could have been me and that, you know. And then another year goes by, and Ali Hunter was in goal, you know, and then Rangers won 3-2, and then another year goes by and it comes up and you're wondering if you're going to be in the team or not, you know. And I was fortunate, you know, that I remember we were down at Sea Mill, and there again, you don't take anything for granted, and you're down at Sea Mill and you're in the dressing room and Big Jock hasn't announced the team and that, you know. And of course we've been having the team talk back in 12 or something like that, you know, and then he says, right, the team is such and such, and it mentioned that I was playing, and Grant Alley turned around to me and says, all the best, big man, good luck to you, that, you know, that was it, you know, and thanks Ali, that, you know, unfortunately there's two of you there and only one of you is going to play, you know, that's it, the way it is. And we know, and I had to phone home and say, you know, phone to my house and say, look, and it was my mum, I says, mum, tell dad I'm playing the cup final, and that, you know, just so that, no, because he didn't know it, then right, after well, there was nothing divulging that, you know.
So after you've been a save in the cup final, for example, right, but would Jock have been full of praise for you after the game, or was it just a case of, that's what you're there for?
It was almost that sort of thing, and that, you know, that you know, he didn't make a point of saying that it was a great save and that, well done and that, you know, because Big Billy, he was talking about something, and Big Billy says, I remember the save the big man had, and he says, aye, virtually, it was one of those, that's what he's there for, that, aye, but it was a good save and that, you know. He told in a quiet way, he didn't go out, you know, make a big issue of it and that, you know, at the time, and that, you know, he'd maybe say something and pass, aye, you done well today, that's what I expect every week. You know, and that would be it, over and done with. But then you knew that's high praise from him. You knew that was high praise from him, and that, you know, that. And okay, that was one instance in the game, and I still remember other aspects. Harry Hood was fabulous that day.
He was good, was he?
Harry was great that day, and that, you know, and he made a couple of goals.
You know, Jim McLean said before the game, I don't know if he was maybe trying to pull our chain, but he said Celtic only have two class players, Dalglish and Negrin, which is no doubt they were class players, but it was more than two in that team.
Oh, that, Stevie Murray was a great player.
Well, you've got Stevie Murray, you've got Jinky on the wing, Davy Hay, you know what I mean? There's a whole number of players there, so I don't know what McLean was trying to achieve, but I think the likes of Harry took up the gauntlet, and he thought, do you think so? And on the day, Harry had won his games.
Oh, he was super.
Scored one and created another two, I think.
Made two, aye, because he made one for Dixon, made that's one right. for Stevie Murray, and that, you know.
The game's done at half time.
Aye, that was it. No, that was, you know, it was a great memory, and that, you know, that's what I remember at the time up, that Harry made a run for me, and that, you know, because Harry knew it was my first cup final, and that, you know. And somebody had asked him, I said, where do you make a rush for the big man? He says, I knew it was his first cup final and that, a big medal for him and that, you know. So
that was a nice touch.
Plus the friendship we had from school and that, you know, it was great and that, you know, it was a great day.
The Drybra Cup competition in 74, so probably your worst moment and your best moment, as the fans recall it, right?
You
might disagree. But this one about Airdrie Broomfield, I'm sure you've been asked 1,000 times. You know, the fact remains that you scored an own goal, a bit of a freak own goal. So in your own words, what happened?
See, if I tried to do it again, I probably couldn't do it. It was actually, I got the ball and I went to throw, I shouted to Danny McGrain. Danny was at left back that day, and I went to throw the ball out, and honestly, I was 12 yards out of goal. I was out running a bit of penalty spot, just slightly to the right hand side of the penalty spot, and Danny was at left back, and I went to throw the ball to Danny, and when I shout at Danny, this player ran towards Danny to block him off, and I tried to stop myself from throwing it, and the ball flew out of my hand way behind me into the back of the net. And you can imagine, I mean, as you rightly say, Stephen, I made the front pages the next day. And on the front page of the Sunday Post or the Sunday Mail, there's a photo of the dugout and Big Joe, Neely Malkin and Bob Rooney, the three of them are sitting there, and Sean Fallon, they're sitting there and they're all laughing and that, and the headline is, what is Big Jock and his staff laughing at, you know? And this is it. It was my goal and that, you know? And Big Billy says to me, Danny, she made it look 10 times worse running after it, which I did. I ran back to try and get it, and I'm still asked to this day about it. And that's the thing that the odd event. Do you remember that day you scored? You threw the ball into the back of your net at Broomfield.
What was the player's reaction then?
They were just dumbfounded, and that, you know, they were in the shower saying, "What were you doing, big man?" And that, you know, and I said, I was going to throw it to Danny, but the fella went to close him down and didn't he want to put Danny in problem. I tried to check myself out, and it was just the way.
And then importantly, what did Big Jock say to you after?
I kept summing along a lot. He says, "Dennis," he says, "you're worse than Frank Harvey. At least Frank could sing." And you're like that, you know.
But a matter of days later, we play Rangers in the final at Hampden. It's a smashing day, it's a smashing game, and it goes to penalty kicks. And the penalty kicks were taken at the Celtic in the front of the Celtic supporters, and you saved two and Celtic won 4-2, so that must have been some feeling.
It was great. It was a tremendous day. I mean, it was, as you rightly said, it was a fabulous day, fabulous game, scorching weather. And the other thing I remember about it, that was the year they'd no offside.
You could only be offside.
They extended the 18-yard box out of the touchline, and you could only be offside inside the 18-yard line. And as I said, it was roasting and that, you know, and the players were exhausted because, you know, they were leaving men right up in the edge of the 18-yard box, that, so the game became more and more.
It was more like a game of basketball, because it was up and down.
And it was one of those days, unfortunately. I think we went in front twice. One of the Rangers goals from memory was actually a deflection. It came off Paddy McCluskey. But when it went to time up, I was always quite confident about, you know, saving penalty kicks. I'd done no bad at Love Street when I was with St Mirren. I had quite a good record. And I knew me Tommy McLean, he'd scored against me at Love Street one time and after Rangers and that, you know, so I was reasonably confident about it, you know, facing it. I would always try and make an effort to get guess right and that, you know, and unfortunately on that day, what made it, what, you know, get my dander up was, our number one penalty kick taker was Wee Lemon, Bobby Lennox, and Wee Bobby took our first round and missed it. And that sort of put a bit added pressure on and that, you know. But things went right for me, I guess. Wee Tommy put one to my left and then Derek Parley hit a higher one harder to my right, and I was fortunate enough to manage to block the two of them and that, you know. So it was a great finish for us and that, you know.
Jinky scored a rare penalty for the first one.
Well, Jimmy, he was the one that scored the winning goal.
It was one of the ones that if the keeper was saved, the goalie's gone in with it.
Aye, that's where we let it put everything and they could behind it and that, you know. I remember and they took it as you said at Celtic and then they ran straight away over to that corner and that, you know, left hand side and that, you know. So it was a great feeling at the end because what I remember at the start of the season, you know, the start of that, the campaign, was it the debacle at Broomfield? And then we were going up to Dundee. But before it started anyway, Big Jock says, this was not a big cup we want to win in that. We'd never won it either.
That's right. Kept getting to the final and getting beat.
Aye. Let's just use it to get match fit and everything else. Then we won at Broomfield, now we're not with Dundee. And after my debacle on the Saturday, I was like, oh, I'll be sitting in the stand. But fortunately enough, he played me. And we won 1-0. And if I'm not mistaken, I don't know if Jim Brogan scored that day.
Jim did score
with
an extra time.
Aye, so we won 1-0 in that, you know. So all of a sudden, a tournament that didn't matter 100 or greatly when you've got Rangers in the final. It's everything. It's the Scottish Cup final, the league decider, and that, you know, any of these games, and that. So all of a sudden, that Rangers became really important, and that, you know, and the build up to it and everything else, and obviously the press were making the most of it. So, and as you said there, Steve, we would never win it before, and that was another off the back, and that, you know, that we'd won it, and I was fortunate enough to save a couple of penalty kicks in it. You know.
So later on that season, Peter Latchford came from England, which was really unusual to get an English player coming north. It was normally the other way about. And, you know, you and Ali, there were still three good goalkeepers at Celtic, but Latchford became the first choice. So really, you know, what I want to ask is, for the best part of a year and a half, you weren't getting a game, you were only playing sporadic games. So what goes through your mind at that point? But were you asking away at that point, or were you fighting hard to get back in?
There's an article came out in one of the papers there not so long ago that I'd actually asked to leave Celtic Park, but I didn't actually ask to leave. Big Joe asked me if I fancied to go to Clydebank. I hadn't, as you rightly say, Steve, you're only playing every second or third reserve game in that, because Ali Hunter's there Big Peter's there, he's in, and Big Joke signed him, so he's going to stand
there. There isn't even a substitute goalie placing the bench in the
No. That's so thing. You're playing every second week in the reserve team, and that, you know, and as I say to people, they say, why do you leave? You become a paid, spectator.
Mm-hmm.
That's all, you know, a paid spectator watching the game and that, you know. Mm-hmm. And everybody's got a bit of pride, they want to be playing everything else and that, and you feel it yourself. So, I mean, I stuck it out for about a year, and then Ali left. First of all, Ali left, they sold Ali, I think Ali went to Motherwell.
Motherwell, that's right.
But then, all of a sudden, Roy Baines came in.
Mm-hmm.
So we were back with three goalkeeping situations again and that, you know, and they were only playing sporadically. And Tommy Callaghan left to go to Clydebank. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if it was an approach through Tommy Callaghan, through the Steedmans, but Big Joe asked me, come up and says, do you fancy going to Clydebank? He says, they'll be understudy when you, even if you go down there, but there's a better chance you can maybe get in a game there than, you know, when if he's just brought in Roy Baines. Just signed Peter a year ago, and he's brought in Roy Baines as well for Morton. There's maybe probably a better chance of getting a wee bit more regular football. I says, aye, Gaffer, I'll go. I says, because I'm not 100% happy and I'm turning up here and sitting in the stand every week. And that was the reason I went, and that, you know, and the Steedmans were quite happy to have me, and that, you know, as cover for Big Jim Gallagher and playing regularly in the Zerns. Now, you're playing once every 2 or 3 weeks if you're lucky and that, you know, you're training Monday to Friday and that's it, you know.
It should be pointed out at that time, Clydebank get promotion at the Premier League, they were a good team.
Aye, they were a good side,
Cooper
yeah.
would have been there at the time, amongst others, he was
who?
David Cooper.
Aye, that's right, Coops was there at the time and he had a couple of really good players. Boy, Jim Ronald, I think, was there at the time and all that, he had 2 or 3 really good players. And they got promotion, so I was quite happy to go down there. There were a good bunch of lads and that, and you were playing regularly in the reserves. At least you were getting a game of football, but see, when you weren't playing, it was just soul-destroying. Soul-destroying, Stevie.
And how did the move to Morton come about? Because I remember you were in Morton at one point.
It was at that stage. The 3 months was up in that year, and Benny Rooney had approached me and that, you know, to see if I fancied coming. But I was working with a company, Dun & Moor, who actually owned Clyde.
By the Ginger People?
The Ginger People and that, you know. And there was another club I asked me, St Johnson was one where you go up to St Johnson, you know. And I was like, no. And Clyde working for the bosses and that, you know. And they're twofold, you know, with a sales rep with them and also play. But no, Benny Rooney asked me if I fancied coming down to Morton and that, you know. So I said, aye, no, you know, I'd go down and that, you know, and give it a go. I wasn't worried about money aspect of it. It was just a game of going and I went down into Morton and Big Andy Ritchie was
there. They were doing well at the time as well.
They were a good side and that, you know. And so I went down there and I thoroughly enjoyed my time down there. We got relegated, but then we ended up winning the old First Division and we went up again and that, you know, so we got promoted and with some good players and that, George Anderson, Davy Hay, Jim Holmes, Big Andy Ritchie and that, you know. And they were a good bunch of lads, so I enjoyed my time there and that, you know, but they brought an American goalkeeper.
Well, I remember him, Pritchett or whatever his name was.
So they brought him over and that, and I was getting on in years and that, you know, and obviously they halved this boy over and that, you know, and I told Ben that, you know, that I didn't fancy another year, you know, just playing reserve team football, and if I was going to do anything, I'd rather do something else, and I then left Morton, went to Clyde for a year. The bosses asked me again, and that, you know, and I said, aye, okay, I'll come and meet Craig Brown as a manager.
The funny thing about the Clyde is he nearly beat Rangers in the Scottish Cup.
That's right, I never played in that
game.
I never played. David McMulliams was in goal.
Oh,
that
right,
time.
Right.
The boy, young boy David McMulliams was in goal in that game.
Because I think Clyde were 2-1 up, about 10 minutes to go,
that's
and
right.
Rangers got a late equaliser, and I always remember that day. It was kind of annoying.
Aye, that's annoying. But and the young boy McMulliams done very well in that, you know. After that, I had a year at Clyde, and then they were bringing in a couple of players and decided, enough's enough. And I went back to Athenley for a year and I enjoyed my year at Athenley, a year and about 15 months I was down there and we got to the final of the Scottish Junior Cup, you know.
Well, the point I was going to make is the last time I certainly remember you playing, but it was live on the telly in the Scottish Junior Cup final and apparently Paul beat Athenley 1-0 and if I'm right, Stevie Fulton's dad scored the winner, so again, there's a wee Celtic link to that, you know.
That's right, yeah. That was it. galling that day. They beat us 1-0, and you know what I mean. It was a great day. The weather had been pouring all week, and Hampden was kind of waterlogged, and you know, there's a lot of surface water on it. But I remember a goal, Norrie Fulton. God rest him, he only died there in the last year, and that, you know, Stevie's dad, and that, you know. But he was a hero at Pollock, and that, you know. And I kicked the ball out, and straight up into the other half of the park, and one of their centre halves headed it straight back into our half. All our defenders just stood, and we Norrie read it right away, and he got through, and as I was going out to try and get it, he got me in first and he lobbed it in, and that, you know, and it finished 1-0, and that, you know. I still take stick for the Pollock fans because I'm very friendly with one of their diehard supporters in after dinner speaker, Bill Copeland, and that, you know, and Bill sends me a text every Saturday night, and that, you know, with all the scores and everything else, and I still keep in touch with him because we do our own annual dinner up here, and that, you know, and Bill comes up and does his MC, but he still gives me stick for the Pollock game or any time I'm down there, and that, you know.
So that was the end of the road at the Arthurley then, and you wound down. So there's just one thing I want to bring up before you go. There was a guy I worked beside, a guy called Stephen McGowan, and his dad was one of the Holyrood goalkeepers, I think, about the same time as you, Kenny McGowan. Hi. So through him, he would just like to say hello to you, and for all time's sake, and it for the old Holyrood days.
Well, Stevie, I'm delighted you brought that up. I remember Big Kenny, he was a big lump of a laddie, and you know, and he was a good goalkeeper, same position as myself, and that, and a lot of competition. But I'm delighted he's still in the go, and that, you know, and he's still living, and I pass on my kindest regards to him. I hope he's in good health.
There's the old goalkeepers union getting together again, Dennis.
That's a close shop.
So thanks for the memories through the years, and the very best wishes for the future.
Steve, it's a pleasure talking to you. I hope I've given you some information you've enjoyed. I've been as honest as I can be in that, you know, but it's been a pleasure talking to you.
I hope you enjoyed that, and if you're in Scotland, I hope you're not being battered too much by Storm Brenda. Anyway, all I would like to say on behalf of anybody and everybody who's appeared on the Celtic Underground podcast, may I wish you and yours the very best wishes for Christmas, and may your worst of 2017 be the best of 2016. Hail, hail, and Merry Christmas. Which service do you require?